week, 365 days a year.
Anyone can make a change, the fear they have the will.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years. Pierre LaFon, Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines. Habitat for Humanity, building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. And CSU Channel Islands, no matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. And speaking of CSU Channel Islands, we have with us today Jenny Luna, a Chicana/O.
Chicano.
Okay, studies professor and a professor of Native American studies. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So it's Chicana slash O. Mm-hmm. Explain the slash O.
Sure. So, and actually some people are, we also say Chicanx studies as well. The term Chicano in the 1960s, there was sort of a revisiting of this term, which it's in Spanish, the male dominance in the language, the O. And so in the 1970s and to the 80s, a lot of Chicana women activists began to question only using Chicano and realizing that many of the women within the Chicano movement were invisibilized, that their histories or herstories were not being told. So they began to demand the incorporation of Chicana and Chicano studies. So actually our discipline in the national level is the National Association for Chicana and Chicano Studies. So it was something that was fought for vehemently by women, scholars, thinkers, activists in the movement. And now, as we're entering into really a more transgender revolution, there is the promotion of the term Chicanx. So Chicana, Chicano, Chicanx. So Chicanx is now challenging the binary Chicana, Chicano, and utilizing the X to talk about being more inclusive when we use the term Chicana, Chicano, Chicanx.
Does that mean I am now fluent in Spanish? Mm-hmm. That I know the answer to that? Does that help my Spanish?
Probably not, but it could, it helps politically to think about identity. Yes.
So this is really a timely moment, not only because of what we'll talk at length about during the show about what's going on in America today, but also there's this tribalism that's taking place in the world, where everyone's turning around and facing themselves, and you've got almost a dissolution of the sense of a nation, and now it's all about family, and I wonder how this fits into the whole this dysphoria of small cultures, but at the same time there seems to be a tightening of other kinds of culture like family. It's sort of paradoxical in my view.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's definitely the separation of families, what's taking place. It's part of the work that I do in thinking about reproductive justice and thinking broadly about how we have to look at our society, our economic policies. We need to look at our social and cultural movements and, social justice issues to think about how all of this fits into this larger movement, which I'm part of, which is this reproductive justice. It's not just about women's health, but it's about keeping families together. It's about having quality education for young people. It's about good health practices, having healthy food accessible to people. All of it is part of, I think, a larger movement.
In fact, your title that I'm using is not really inclusive enough, because I didn't, when I said Chicano and Native American studies, you're also an expert at the science of being a doula.
Correct.
And the reason that you're involved with both is?
For that same reason, that reproductive justice is part of, it's part of when we're looking at the survival of indigenous peoples, the survival of Chicana, Chicano communities, it's dependent on the health, the reproductive health of women.
So why is there a difference? Clearly, you know, emerging nations, poverty, there are huge differentials in healthcare between the big nations and people with wealth. But why is it good to look at some of the indigenous people's medicine? I mean, should we go back to, bloodletting because it used to be something that people believed in? Or shouldn't everyone get the same kind of scientific health healthcare? Why are you focusing on something that is not in the mainstream right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there can be a healthy partnership looking at traditional medicinal practices as well as Western practices. And we see that there's a place for Western practices, absolutely, and that we can work in collaboration. What has taken place is the shaming and obliteration of traditional midwifery practices, particularly Mexican midwifery practices. And so now we're seeing even in Mexico where it's deemed shameful. It's something that people reject, that to be born in a hospital is seen as modernity. It's desirable, whereas being born at home with a midwife is somehow seen as backward.
But is it? I mean, if it were my daughter, I would want her to have a child in a hospital just because of emergencies. Is it clearly, if people can't afford to go to a hospital, they ought to be able to do it as safely as possible. But you don't want to aspire. Let me ask the question. Do you want to aspire to those traditional ways, or are you better off in a hospital if you can afford it?
Well, it's being questioned for two reasons. One is that the U.S. has one of the highest maternal and infant death rates in the world. We are looking at, I have a statistic here, 700 to 900 women in the U.S. died from pregnancy-related causes in 2016. We're also looking at the price, the cost of healthcare, where we cannot afford healthcare anymore. And so people are opting to have access to having their babies at home, which is actually more affordable and it's very safe. It's, people like to joke about the oldest occupation in the world. The oldest occupation in the world is midwifery, that women have always been delivering babies. It's been a practice that has happened, since the time of humanity. And so since the beginning of humanity.
My Wall Street friends said it was bond trading, but I guess they were wrong. Okay, I got this. Obviously it was giving birth.
Midwifery, yes, giving birth. And so the medicalization of birthing has removed birthing from the home, from families. The control of birthing has been removed from women, that it's now in the hands of medical professionals who tend to be white males. And so that is problematic.
Speaking of white males, how about the story in the last 2 days about the American delegation at the UN not signing on to an initiative to make information about breastfeeding to emerging countries, and rather to push Enfamil with that no one can afford? I mean, that is beyond the beyond.
But that's been happening for a long time. If you were born in the 1970s, you had companies like Nestle that were pushing and telling mothers that it's healthier to have formula and pushing it through the hospital. And when babies are given formula through a bottle in the very beginning of their life, they tend to not latch on to do breastfeeding afterwards. So this has been happening in this country for a very long time. And so it's time for us to really think about how we can reclaim not only traditional birthing practices, but what is natural to birth.
So in your coursework, in your teaching, though, you're teaching it from a sociological, political viewpoint. This isn't, you're not teaching how to do it. I mean, this is not part of the nursing program.
No, but I am working in collaboration with the nursing program. And I am a doula. We call it doula. We're kind of moving towards the term community birth worker. Mm-hmm. But I have been a practicing doula for I'm going to say about 12 years now. I've helped in about 35 births at this point. So I'm not in the STEM field, but it's something that I've been doing for quite a while. And so I've incorporated birth work into my academic research and teaching.
Is that unique? Other people in other universities that teach what you teach, did they also ever bring in the doula part?
We're very unique in the fact that we have an entire class in the Chicana and Chicano Studies program dedicated to reproductive justice. That is not familiar. I'm not familiar with any other program. I know that people will teach the issues, but the fact that I have an entire semester where I teach this subject, that is very unique to any other program.
And this is consistent with Dr. Beck's vision for CSU Channel Islands, where there's an openness to professors to expand the traditional curriculum and to work with other departments and to do work that is associated with that can be associated with their basic work, but necessarily is. And, you know, it's really an open place to try new things out. And this is sort of emblematic of that.
Absolutely. To have an interdisciplinary program that's critical for our campus.
I couldn't think of the word interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. And so I spent four sentences saying what you just said in one word. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone?
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Professor Jenny Luna, a Chicana and Native American studies professor. And before the break, we were talking about her role in teaching about being a doula, and she mentioned that she was a doula for 12 years. How did she become interested in that? Mm-hmm. Your academic credentials are stellar, and nowhere do I see, I think I want to do, you know, ancient birthing rites. How did you get an interest in that?
Actually, when I was a graduate student, when I was doing my PhD in Native American Studies at UC Davis, we had a course on Native American women. And in just some of my research, I just became interested, and I thought, you know, we continue to maintain certain practices, I think, in many indigenous communities. But what is taking place, and what would that mean if we were to reclaim birth practices? What kind of impact would that have long term, in terms of you know, substance abuse, child abuse, these types of things? If we bring back the ceremonies and we bring back the ways of the ancestors, of how they respected the birth as a ceremony, then maybe that might change in the long term the issues that we were seeing in our communities right now.
You know, now talking about indigenous people, there are indigenous communities, Ventura and Santa Barbara. First of all, can you define indigenous? Is that, what is an indigenous indigenous mean for someone living in Santa Barbara and Ventura? Where are they from?
Right. Well, when we're talking about the first peoples in this area, we're talking about the Chumash. The term indigenous actually evolves out of an international movement. When we're looking at the etymology of terminology and words, we can argue different, evolutions of how these words come about. But the term indigenous is kind of globally, there's a global consensus that we use that word when we're talking about the first peoples of different land bases, pre-invasion. And so in this community, in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties, we're talking about the Chumash peoples being the first peoples, the native peoples, the indigenous peoples of this area. But what's interesting is California in this country, in the U.S., is the most diverse of indigenous peoples. So you have communities and nations, First Nations, all throughout California, unlike any other state.
Give me examples. What are they? Who are these people?
So starting, up, we have Pomos, Miwoks, we have the Kumeyaay down south in San Diego, the Muekma, Ohlone peoples. So we're talking hundreds of different nations of indigenous peoples throughout California compared to other states that may have 9 or 5. In California, we have hundreds of indigenous communities throughout California that are sovereign and autonomous with their own languages, their own traditions. But in California, because of migration, the largest indigenous community in California is actually the Mixteco people. And so that is a new phenomenon, in the last decade or so or longer probably, because of the migration of indigenous peoples from Oaxaca, Mixtecos, Zapotecs. We've seen different waves. So in Ventura County, for example, there was at one point a wave of Yucatecos from Mayans coming into the area. Then there's a different wave of migrants. And so the Mixtecos are the most recent wave and have now become the largest indigenous population in California.
And these are people that never left. I mean, these are people not that immigrated back into the country. These are people that have been here from the beginning.
Correct. Well, these are the Mixtecos are migrating from Oaxaca. Most of them are migrating to California for work. Mm-hmm. As we know, migrants, when they move to a new place, they maybe develop relationships, they buy homes, they have families, and so they stay here. And a lot of times when people migrate, they migrate to places where they have kinship. So you'll see a community that they all come from the same community in Mexico, that they word got around that this is the place to go in Oxnard, and let's go there. And so we start to see the growth of these communities in Ventura and Santa Barbara County.
And that's so true for every generation. My grandmother and my wife's grandfather dated it in 1905. We found out when my grandmother was about to die because everyone from that immigration period at the turn of the last century who were the same ethnic background lived in the same streets. So when we tell that story, people say, wow, it's amazing. No, it's not so amazing. People just sort of end up going to where they are all the same. And what I find interesting, speaking of immigration, nice segue, I took my grandchildren to Ellis Island 3 weeks ago in New York. And even though I'm a New Yorker, I know it's hard to believe that since I've lost my accent completely, but as a New Yorker, I had never been to Ellis Island. And what's so fascinating to me, among other things, is that I learned when you walk in, there's this huge staircase, beautiful staircase, but high. And the reason they put it there is because they wanted people in steerage to walk up the steps to see if they could make it. Mm. Because if they couldn't make it, they were turned away. And the stories that were told in the museum are just as horrible as the stories we hear today. And so some of the things that we are, that at least some of us are appalled at, that we're doing today to immigrants, it's not new. Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of the history of this country. People Absolutely. Come in and then they don't want anyone else to come behind them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same history for Native people who are not immigrants. Yeah. But, Native people, indigenous peoples are not immigrants, and they have experienced their children being taken away by the U.S. government into federal boarding schools, state boarding schools. This is the separation of children from their families is very much a part of the dark history of the U.S.
So is there,
I know with the Chumash, because as you know, sometimes capitalism really works in the favor of something good. You know, the Chumash, at least up in Santa Ynez, make a lot of money from gambling, and now they're putting it back into awareness about people's. Is there, you know, back in the 70s, the Indian population in this country, you know, were stereotyped as, you know, people don't go to school, they drink too much, they fight. Mm-hmm. Now there's a whole renaissance taking place. So is there going to be, because of this immigration, a renaissance, if you will, a resurgence in understanding and pride among these indigenous mm-hmm. groups, as opposed to a dysphoria where they want to be able to reclaim their mm-hmm. heritage rather than just to assimilate?
Right. Well, some might argue that when we use this idea of to reclaim, that it was never unclaimed. So when we look at indigenous peoples throughout California or those that have migrated from other parts of the continent into the U.S., that you know, they never, those, the sense of pride, of cultural wealth was never unclaimed, that they still maintain it. But unfortunately, some of the issues that you mentioned, like poverty, substance abuse, a lot of these issues and health issues like diabetes, these come about as a direct result of colonization. The fact that peoples were taken away from their food sources, they were given government subsidies that replaced traditional food practices, the fact that they were, their ceremonies, their ways of life were prohibited, were banned, were considered crimes to practice their ceremonies. So that the direct correlation of the history of colonization and colonialism in this country towards indigenous peoples is what caused that. So when we say a resurgence, I think that those things have always been there, but there are waves. We can look at the 1970s as one of those waves of movements, the American Indian movement, AIM, and you know, the Red Power movement, the Chicano movement, the Black Power movement. These were moments in our history where people began to question what was happening in society and also taking power into their own hands, education into their own hands. They realized that the government was not providing the education that they deemed necessary for their youth, and so they began to take it into their own hands. So, yes, there is absolutely, and sometimes because of moments of pressure, we begin to resist. And so definitely there is a moment right now where people are resisting. And in that resistance, we see this resurgence of reclaiming power. The ethnic studies movement is one of those movements. So we're reclaiming power. We're reclaiming all of these things that have been taken away from us as a result of colonization. But I do believe that that pride, that history, the culture has always been within our communities.
Well, I think what also is happening, you've got people that now will take pride in who they are, whereas assimilation is not as the paramount objective. People will not just practice their traditions at home, but they'll go out and say, "I am who I am." And that's true, you know, whether it's the LGBT or whether it's any type of ethnic group, which is a real change. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, Improving Attitude, Creating Social Harmony, Bridging the Achievement Gap for Teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Jenny Luna, Professor Jenny Luna of Chicano and Chicana Studies and Native American Studies, and becoming a doula and probably anything else we can think of that the university needs. She's willing to teach every course in the school, which will be very economic for the school.
I teach quite a few courses, I do.
So who takes these courses? Is it a broad group of people, or is it, you know, Mexican heritage kids? Who takes
courses? It's a broad group of students. My reproductive justice course specifically is cross-listed with health communications, with nursing, and I think that's it. Yeah, it's cross-listed. So I have students from the STEM fields that are taking the class. Across the board, students are interested.
And what about Chicana Studies? Who's taking that course?
It's interesting because we have quite a few majors and we have hundreds of minors. So we have a lot of students who are interested. I have students who are in environmental science, but they minor in Chicana and Chicano Studies because that is the place where they feel grounded, where they feel community. Oftentimes when we have students of color, particularly Chicana and Chicano students taking our classes, they might be in these other courses, STEM fields, and they don't necessarily feel like they belong. So Chicano Studies is really the anchor for a lot of our students on campus. We're 50% Chicano Latino students at Cal State Chicano Islands. And so we serve not only those who wish to study Chicana and Chicano Studies, but we're serving the entire campus, not just the 50% Chicano Latino students, but, you know, all of our students that come and they find a home with us, because it really is a place of critical conversation, of engaging with strategies and transformation towards social justice.
And when they graduate, if they major in the subject, what do they do for a living besides teach?
Right. I have students that have gone on to public health. We have quite a few students that go on into public health. Students have taken my classes that have decided they'd like to work in public health. We have students who have gone on to law school, students who want to work in public policy, students, and of course, we have quite a few teachers, those that want to. I have a student that just graduated who's going to San Francisco State to do a master's in migration studies, borderland studies. So we have students really in a broad array of areas.
So you recently got a grant from the National Center for Science and Civic Engagement?
Yes.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, my team, myself, and I partnered with MICOP, the Mixteco Indigena Community Organizing Project. So my partner organization, we were one of four grants awarded in the nation. And our grant is basically we're being supported to further the course, the reproductive justice course, but to develop a doula program. And so a doula or community birth work program. So this year
what's their motivation? Why does the National Center for Science want to see this happen?
Well, their goal is to, and it's interesting because I'm not a STEM person, neither is obviously my partner in the grant, but all the other grantees were in the STEM fields. So their focus is on science and how do we enhance education, not only of the students at the university, but also partnering with community partners so that science education is not necessarily only driven by the university, but driven by the community. And so we have, it's more heavy on the environmental sciences. So we have communities, different Native communities that are looking at fishing rights, water rights, and how can they engage with the local university to drive some of the research that needs to be done to preserve, water rights, for example. So our program, I think we were very unique because we didn't necessarily come from a STEM field, but it directly connects to students who are in STEM, particularly students that are nursing. And as you may be familiar, our campus has an excellent, renowned program in nursing. And so we do connect with a lot of our nursing students and students that are in the health sciences.
Yeah, just let me expand on that. I don't want to use the word campus. I want to use the word campuses, mm-hmm. because Santa Barbara is an important part of the CSU
yes.
campus up here.
Absolutely.
So just make mm-hmm. clear that our people here in Santa Barbara are getting the benefit of this program.
That's right.
So Vanessa Terran.
Terran.
Mm-hmm. Terran. Mm-hmm. What she brings to it that you don't, mm-hmm. or you guys work together?
Yes. So she's a program manager with MICOP, the Mixteco Indígena Community Organizing Project. And so her and I applied for the grant together. So she really, she's one of the most dedicated, committed people I know in the community in Oxnard. And so she is my connection with the organization and a representative of the organization. And so she is bringing in people from the community, particularly those in the Mixteco community, to work jointly on these issues of reproductive health, because we have had cases of health disparities, discrimination of Mixteco women that have gone into local hospitals to give birth and maybe don't have someone that speaks their language, no translation, or they have been fearful of going to the hospital. So she sees a benefit from us that we can provide this program to educate the community and provide services to the Mixteco community specifically, but really to the indigenous community generally.
You may not know the answer to this, but if a undocumented pregnant woman goes into a hospital, are they mandated reporters to ISIS?
To ICE.
Yeah.
No. No, they are not. No, everyone who comes to the hospital is served. But I think that there definitely is a fear. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a fear for people that go to the hospital, which creates can create complications in pregnancy. I mean, there is a recent study out of the New York Times a few months ago that talked about Black women and maternal death rates and infant mortality being directly associated, and being accepted by the medical community, associated with issues of racism. And that racism increases this level of stress, and over time, and living in a society that has an extreme amount of racism, that's going to affect a woman when she goes into labor, can increase the rates of preeclampsia or high blood pressure, hypertension, and that's going to directly affect the outcomes.
And is it racism or is it economic disparity?
I would say it's both. I mean, those things intersect. I mean, race, class, gender, all of those things intersect.
I've mentioned this a few times on the show, but one of the local people here, a philanthropist, has a think tank, which some of your professors participate in every year, about early childhood education. Mm-hmm. And a great deal of the work that's being done now show that not only is 0 to 3 the most important part of brain development for children, but in vitro.
Yes.
If depending upon the music the mother listens to, mm-hmm. depending upon the anxiety the mother has when she's pregnant, influences
exactly.
the child's long-term development. So what you're saying is just not a matter of being inconvenienced psychologically for the mother. It really has a long-term impact.
Correct.
On the kids.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if somebody is finds themselves ready to give birth on the border. Mm-hmm. Are there doula volunteers that are available mm-hmm. to provide for those who are either afraid to go to a hospital or have no access to a hospital?
Correct. So there's an amazing midwife colleague of mine who also came into the partnership. Her name is Thema Mercado, and she's part of, she began, her business is La Matriz Birthing. And so she is in the process of developing a midwifery center, a birthing center on the border. There's also one in El Paso, which I've visited, but she's trying to create this birthing center on the border. You have a lot of refugees, particularly Haitian refugees, that arrived into Tijuana and needed these types of services. And so those were not being provided. So she saw this this particular midwife who's from San Diego, saw the need and went out to Tijuana and is now providing these types of services, prenatal care, birth services. So that is happening as a result of Thema Mercado and her colleagues as well.
The course on about being a doula, it's not a STEM program, so you don't teach them how to do it, do you? This is about,
yes, we do.
Oh, you do?
We do, yeah. We actually hire the midwife, Thema Mercado, who does the training, and she did the training for us. And so that's step one. So she did the training, and she's also gives us advice and shows us some of the medical procedures. So doulas, we do not catch babies. That's the job of the midwife or the doctor. All of the births that I've assisted have actually been in the hospitals. Doulas or community birth workers, we assist mothers from prenatal care all the way through delivering the placenta. So we're there as a birth support team.
And you teach after the birth breastfeeding too, right?
Yes, we can also do that. Yes, yeah. We can do full spectrum care.
Yeah, I know someone recently in New York that had a doula come to their house to teach breastfeeding. I mean, so this is not a developing country. So, you know, there is value here for everybody.
Absolutely.
Because hospitals sometimes really don't do this.
That's right.
Can men be a doula?
Yes, we actually had one man in our first inaugural doula class, and we did have one man that he was also a nursing student that wanted to be a doula.
Wow, I wonder how women are going to feel about that.
Well, it's the woman who's giving birth.
Yeah,
she gets to decide who's her doula.
Oh, okay.
And so we are offering. So the in general, women who choose to have a doula, they usually interview and whoever they feel comfortable with. And so, but I think anyone who has the ability and the care to give to a woman in labor, I think we need as many people as we can to support women in birth.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone?
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, helping teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Professor Jenny Luna, a Chicana Studies professor and professor of Native American Studies at CSU Channel Islands. And we're talking about the doula program. Mm-hmm. And what is the history behind burying the placenta? Is there scientific information behind that?
Well, there's different people do different things with the placenta. In many Mexican traditional midwifery, the burying of the placenta, when you look at it, if you've ever seen a placenta, it actually looks like a tree. It looks like the veins of the placenta. It looks like a tree. So historically, it's called the tree of life, because really that's it's this amazing organ that develops on its own. The woman develops an organ just for a particular moment for 9 months to nourish the baby. And so planting the umbilical cord as well as the placenta, you plant it, traditionally you would plant it in the home where the baby's born. So that way the baby always comes back home, but also it knows its roots. It knows where it's, the child knows where they come from. So that's one way. But there's some people who also, I heard a beautiful story by some Hawaiian sisters that were doulas, that they would actually transport the placenta on the canoe to the island where the family comes from. So there's this connection of life, this tree of life. It's part of the human body that this woman created. So you give it back to the earth. So it's more of a ceremonial. But there's also many people that are now doing placenta encapsulation.
In order to keep the stem cells.
They're making placenta encapsulation and taking it after birth. And there's some scientific evidence to show that it helps with postpartum depression and that it helps to replenish, the mother as she's breastfeeding and caring for her baby in the first months of life.
And what's a rebozo shawl?
So, yes, the rebozo. It's this beautiful, amazing, magical tool that many midwives use that we can – I use it just to help with different positions, like labor positions. So we can also, wrap the rebozo around the ankles, and the woman can use that as leverage as she's pushing the baby. There are ways that some midwives know how to use the rebozo to wrap it around the belly to shift the baby. So if the baby's not positioned correctly, you can use the rebozo to shift the baby.
So it's a functional thing, not just an artifact for traditional behavior.
Absolutely. And afterwards, you wrap the baby and you can carry the baby in the rebozo on your back or in front of you.
Can I get it on Amazon?
You can find a rebozo. They're very readily available, and they're also very beautiful.
And I guess the last question about this, you also employ nutrition, and you use herbs and foods.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
How does that help?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I do a lot of prenatal care, and so I talk about how, for women, what are some of the diets that are, plant-based diet, going back to traditional diet. So that's going to look different for different indigenous people. So if you are Inuit from Alaska, eating whale blubber might be really healthy for your traditional diet. If you are from Mexico, corn, squash, beans. So thinking about what is the traditional diet, going back to that, I think is really important.
Are you partnered with any medical center?
Well, currently, my colleague, Lasagna Davis, who is Dr. Lasagna Davis, who's at Cal State Channel Islands in the nursing program, I'm working with her, and she also places students at St. John's Hospital. And so we're working on a partnership with them to after we train these doulas, they're going to, these who are college students and community members for MICOP, they'll actually be volunteering to help women in labor. So women who come into the hospital giving birth, we will give them the option that if they would like a doula, and we'll be on call to provide a volunteer doula for them.
So to be admitted to any of these programs that you teach, do you have to be bilingual?
No, you do not. No. I mean, it's always helpful. I think it's absolutely helpful to be bilingual. But as I said before, some of these women, indigenous women, don't speak Spanish. They speak their indigenous language. They speak Mixteco, Zapotec, Nahuatl. And so it's really not necessarily the language, although that would be helpful, but it's about the care that we show for women and that we're able to communicate as best as we can their options.
The studies that you do, and I guess this is either fortuitous if you're looking to become the highest paid professor at CSU or depressing if you care about our society, but what's going on now in our country has made everything that you do so much more relevant. Yeah. And so, in a sense, we've got a political situation here that's exacerbating a situation that would exist anyway.
Right.
So, what is the outlook with kids being separated from their parents? This is way beyond the usual problems of integrating society. This must have a tremendous impact both on people who just see it happening and the people who are experiencing it.
Well, yes, absolutely. But I mean, again, going back to history, we can look at the 1970s where you had 25,000 Native women that were forcibly sterilized under federal programs of Indian Health Services. We had thousands of women, Mexican American women, in LA County that were sterilized without their consent. So this is the history of, it's not only about the separation of children from their families and what's taking place right now, but it's also looking at that these issues have been ongoing. So it's not about only taking away children, but also preventing women from having the right to their own reproductive health, to having the right to make choices about their body. And so historically, to know that thousands of women, indigenous women, were denied the right to have children without their consent, without their knowledge, this is well documented. We're dealing with the history of eugenics in California specifically, that it was women of color, particularly Mexican-American women, that were most affected by these policies. And that's what we're seeing today. We're seeing these policies where we're looking at Mexican people as the most undesirable people, and therefore they need to be tortured. They need to be removed. You have women that are in detention centers that are pregnant, and they're forced to give birth in shackles. These are women who are forced to give birth in front of security guards. And so we, to deny women their reproductive rights, it is a travesty of what's happening in our society right now.
And do you teach the history? Because one of the problems I have with young people, besides the fact that they're young and I'm not, is that they don't know so many things that they think everything is happening just now to them, whatever is on Twitter. But so many things have happened over the eons that are precursors to what's happening today. Mm-hmm. So is part of the curriculum a history lesson?
Absolutely. If we don't know where we come from, we don't know where we're going. And so history is critical. And I think that I want to advocate for those who have never taken a Chicana Chicano Studies class, you should definitely take a class, because I think it is definitely a space where we it's a transformative space where people come out very different after learning the history that we teach in our classes.
So over the last 50 years, Black Studies has become mainstream in the sense that every school has a Black Studies program. Mm-hmm. Is there any friction between a Black Studies program and a Chicana program? Do they, or is everyone on the same page?
We are on the same page that we believe in ethnic studies, that ethnic studies needs to, it's happening now in California. We're on the pathway to make it a high school graduation requirement. We believe that ethnic studies should exist. It's a studies of the people. It's the only discipline in history that was created by and for people, that it was the people that fought for that. And so I believe that we're on the same page that we need to have across the board a very strong, robust ethnic studies in all universities across this nation and high schools and elementary schools, K through 12, gestation through postgraduate school. That's what we believe. I think it's oftentimes universities and the struggle for resources that ends up pitting people against each other, which, again, it's very difficult within the institution because we're always fighting for resources and we're placed in that position to be fighting for resources. So I think it's critical that we work together. And I definitely believe that is happening. That has always happened. It's when people come together, when we have a multiracial justice agenda, that is when things happen. Change happens.
I feel like after you just said all that, I should say I will vote for you. You sound like you're running for office. We should. I'm going to vote for you. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education, and believe it or not, we'll be right back with our final segment.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Professor Jenny Luna from CSU Channel Islands, a professor of Chicana Studies and Native American Studies. And this is something that interest that you have, it started when you were what, 4 years old, 10 years old? How did you get interested in this?
Actually, in high school. Yeah. In high school, I read my first, I was very fortunate because my sophomore year, I was assigned a book by Rudolfo Anaya, Bless Me Ultima, and it opened my eyes to Chicano literature. And after that, I was hooked. I read every book I could get my hands on that was part of the genre of Chicano literature. I knew when I was going to, I went to Berkeley as an undergrad, and I majored in Chicana and Chicano studies, and I knew that that was my path. Yeah, and I also, as when I was 15 years old, I started doing Aztec dance. And Danza Mexica. And so as a dancer, it really opened up pathways for me to make relationships with other indigenous communities. And so from there, I've been very involved in the indigenous world internationally and locally.
And the other thing that you did, which is why you're so eloquent when you speak, is you went to Columbia's education school, which is fantastic, and got a master's degree in education.
Yes.
And so, you know, I taught when I came out here after I retired, and I found teaching to be the most difficult thing I've ever done. Because
it is.
Teaching is, you think you know something, but until you teach it, you don't know it.
It's also a political act, because as a teacher, you're engaged with the redistribution of power, that students who are never meant to be part of the educated class, that you're engaged in this redistribution of power, and really it's an equalizer in many ways. It can be when it's used in and taught in the appropriate way.
I wonder if there's a special sense of responsibility you have teaching in a school that's 50% Mexican as opposed to teaching it at Princeton where, you know, they all speak like they come from Boston. I'm kidding. But is there a sense of responsibility to these kids?
Yes, because they're most of them are first-generation college students. And so they are literally changing their family trees, their genealogy. They are changing the next generations. I believe education is very powerful when you do something with it. And it does have the power to literally change the trajectory of your family history.
I went to the graduation this year at CSU, and it was amazing because I think, I don't know, there were 1,800 kids over the two different graduations, the morning and the afternoon program. And when the president said, first person in the family to go to school stand up, it looked like three quarters of the people stood up.
I was one of them.
I'm
a first generation college student.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah.
It's so, to me, it's very personal. It's very personal to be at Cal State Channel Islands. I am honored every day. I feel privileged to be able to teach the students that we have at our campus.
Well, we're lucky to have you here. We're lucky to have CSU Channel Islands here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank everyone for listening. You've been listening to AHA Presents About Education, and we'll be back next week.
It's 3.